harping on is that the Human Genome Project did not deliver on its original scientific and medical promises, and then I'm contradicting myself almost in the next sentence by saying, still, it is one of the most important scientific developments ever, the completion of the human genome sequence. And then, of course, in a situation like that, it's perfectly fair to come and ask me why. Why can't you both at one end saying that by its own criteria it's a failure and then call it one of the greatest successes ever? At the scientific level, the answer to that question is fairly straightforward, right? And that scientific answer is the following. What the Human Genome Project thought it would do is they would find genes for definite traits, and you would get this predictive biology where you'll have a computer program making predictions. The input would be somebody's DNA sequence, and the output would be behavior, whether that person has disease X or condition Y or whatever it is. That clearly we can't do, and lots of people, including me, have been saying all along, we would not be able to do. Genes just are not that powerful. Okay, we tend to study genes when there are clear phenotypic effects. For most of the things that happen in your bodies is a complicated mess of gene and environmental interactions, and you're not going to be able to predict them by genetic genetic sequences alone. But then why is it a success? Well, from a scientist's point of view, finding out how bizarre the human genome is just makes life look very, very different. What do I mean by that? That we have only 20,000 genes or so, 21,000 genes, and that's responsible for all the complicated things that go on in our body in terms of constraining them, that every gene gets used roughly 2 to 3 times to make 3 different proteins. We have this huge mystery that there's this bundle of DNA, 99% of the DNA in our body seems to be doing absolutely nothing at all. Rice has more genes than us. Why does rice have more genes than us? So there, it just opens up an entirely new field that biology has to understand. And to the extent science is self-sustaining, this ability to open up new fields of inquiry is amazingly important. Everybody clear on that? Okay? But then I go on to say that since about 5 years ago, we can also say that something has come out of the Human Genome Project that has very important and, if we use it properly, good consequences for medicine and society, right? That's something I would not have said, and I did not say, would not even thought possible in 2010. Okay, 1910 too, but I wouldn't have been there in 1910. Okay, in 2010, but that's changed. And why is that? Well, that's because genomics led to the discovery of CRISPR mechanisms, all right? So the first part of what I'm gonna do today is talk about what the CRISPR mechanism is. How many of you had some, at least informal encounter with CRISPR before? So most of you already, and most of you then presumably know something about the mechanism, so I'm gonna schematize it and make it as simple as possible, right? Well, look, the story begins in the 1990s. In a laboratory in Japan, a graduate student was studying a certain gene called the IEP, and a gene that makes an enzyme in bacteria, E. coli bacteria, the stuff that's all over your, inside your intestines. There's a strain of E. coli called K12. Which was extracted in the 1920s from the feces of a patient in Stanford University Hospital. And that K12 strain of E. coli has been the most commonly used organism for molecular genetics since the 1960s. He was working on that. And so as he did this, he decided that he would go and study what the sequence would be in the flanking regions, okay? In the late 1990s, it was still possible to do a huge amount of sequencing and get a PhD out of that. It no longer was the case that sequencing a single gene would give you a PhD as it was in the 1980s. Technology has gotten better, but the Human Genome Project was towards its halfway point, and large-scale sequencing machines were just becoming available, so sequencing still was a research problem and not entirely a technical problem, and that's what he was trying to do. And he wanted to sequence these other sequences, the flanking sequences of the gene, because very often genes are turned on or off. They are regulated by proteins that can sit here or here, right? If the protein sticks here, the gene often does not get expressed. If the protein gets pulled off, the enzymes can see the gene and express it. So he did that. And he noticed that over here, in this flanking region, he began to see repeats. There were repeats, R1, R2, repeated sequences, 7 or 8 of them that were repeated. And these were almost exact repeats, but internally, they had the structure of a palindrome. What do I mean by that? So a sequence like this would be of the following sort. If you get AT, let's say ATTCGAC, right? The next part would be GTCGAAT. I was drawing this last time, right, in class, so that this would correspond to this by base pair. Why am I writing with my left hand? This would correspond to this by base pair complementarity, this with this, and all of that. So there'd be an internal palindromic sequence, and that in between these repeats were spacers. These were also sequences of DNA, but those didn't seem to have any pattern at all, right? And then his advisor realizes something, this is something weird, that there have been lots and lots of weird repeated sequences following bacteria all over, but never quite this structure of repeats separated by spacers. Everybody with me? So he did what any reasonable person would do. He began to look at every sequence that was available of bacteria and see where he found them. And he found them in about 80% of bacteria, not all of them and all of it. And a few years later, somebody working in Spain also began finding them in RK. That's the third kingdom that you have, eukaryotes, RK, and bacteria, roughly. Those are the three kingdoms. They had to find them there too. Nobody exactly knew what they did. But when you see that many repeats, even if you're like me, the same thing occurring over and over again, even if you're like me and you don't like to give functional and adaptationist explanations immediately, there's a strong suggestion that there is some function out there, right? I mean, you shouldn't just assume it's function, you should look for it and see if you can find it. By about 2004, it became clear what was happening, that these spacers coded enzymes, okay? And one of the enzymes they coded ultimately came to be called Cas9. It was the 9th such enzyme found, and Cas is a short for CRISPR-associated. CRISPR-associated gets Cas. And what did this Cas9 enzyme do? It went and snipped, okay, DNA. Wherever it saw DNA, it snipped it, right? And then over the next 5 or 6 years, it was worked out what the function of these CRISPR sequences were. So it turns out that these CRISPR sequences are often derived from viruses. So virus comes and attacks the bacteria, right? The bacteria eventually is going to die. Bacteria don't have a very good chance surviving viruses unless it internally, spontaneously already has immunity to the virus. But what the bacteria do is just cut up all the DNA of the virus in its fight against it, right? And some of this DNA gets taken up by the bacteria and inserted into these CRISPR regions, okay, over there. And so there are various CRISPR regions, they have that inserted. And then what happens is that the next time that virus comes and attacks a bacteria of that sort, typically not in that generation, the next generation, right? There's a lot of complexity I'm glossing over now, which it has taken us quite a while theoretically to work out. The main figure is somebody by the name of Koonin in Washington, D.C., in the National Laboratory of Standards. So what this does is that these bacteria do is a virus comes and attacks it. The bacteria generates mRNA from this entire sequence, right? Now notice this part was derived from the virus itself. So it goes and seeks out the virus DNA and stick to it. And then Cas9 gets expressed. It's brought along a cutter, right? A DNA cutter with it. Then the Cas9 gets expressed, and the enzyme goes and cuts up the virus, and the bacteria gets protected from the virus. So CRISPR-Cas9 is essentially an acquired immune system that bacteria have. Everybody with me? Okay, are there any questions? All right. At this stage, when I teach philosophy of biology, we spend a lot of time worrying about, is this Lamarckian inheritance? Is the bacteria acquiring from their environment something that makes them fitter in the same environment? It turns out, after a lot of analyzing experiments, that that's false. It actually, the bacteria that acquires the CRISPR first typically only survives because the virus that entered it was defective in the first place. And it's in the next generation that you begin to have an active immunity generated by CRISPR. We work out the subtleties of all of this. I don't want to go there now. All you need to understand, at the population level of bacteria, the CRISPR mechanism serves as an immune mechanism. Everybody with me? Okay? All right. After this is worked out between 2006 to 2010, people began to wonder as to, can this be used for gene editing? So how would you use it for gene editing? What you would do is you would generate a CRISPR sequence where in the spacer here, right, you put two things in a CRISPR sequence. You put Cas9, but you also put something that I like to call as a recognition sequence. So let's say I want to go inside your body, and I have one of your cells, right, doesn't matter where, and I want to target a particular gene. Not necessarily very easy thing to do, right? There are all those genes around and all of that, and I just send in any old enzyme that goes and cuts DNA. It will cut your DNA all over the place. Everybody with me? Now suppose, and that DNA, let's say, that enzyme is Cas9. But suppose I attach to Cas9 a recognition sequence, right, that hones in on near the exact sequence I want to snip in that particular gene. Everybody with me? Okay. And now I load all of this inside a CRISPR array in the spacer and shove it inside your cell. The mRNA produced by this will go off and select the gene to be cut with a high level of precision, and then the Cas9 will get to work and cut it. All right. So I've solved the cutting part. So here's my spacer. Right. That's a repeat I plus one. This is the repeat I. Those are the CRISPR things. So I've added the recognition part. I've added CRISPR, Cas9. And now I could add in here a load, right? A load of whatever gene I want to insert there. It could be a corrected version of a deficient gene that you have there, or it could be an entirely new gene. I can put anything there, and as long as the enzymes around that repair DNA, that gene complex would get inserted exactly where Cas9 had been cut. Everybody with me? So potentially, I can precisely edit genes anywhere in the genome. Okay. Now, I said that the discovery of all of this is a result of HGP, Human Genome Project. Why? Well, the Human Genome Project made a huge, huge number of sequences easily available. And that's what led people first to realize that something peculiar was going on with this CRISPR, this repeated CRISPR sequences, right? And then be able to come up with the idea that eventually these generate immunity, and that spawns the idea that I can use the same technique to try to edit genes. And sort of under the radar, people began working on the system a fair amount, and ultimately the problem was simultaneously solved both at Berkeley and in a laboratory at France, and the system got fully designed. In a wonderful act of intellectual cheating, a laboratory at MIT managed to get the patent for it, and so far the courts have upheld that patent, even though it's clear that the MIT people did not discover it. The original discovery was at Berkeley in France, and that battle is continuing in the courts. At stake is billions of dollars, because the pharmaceutical industry is going to make a huge amount of money from this gene editing method. Everybody with me? Okay? Is the mechanism clear, especially for those of you who half knew about CRISPR but didn't know exactly what happens? And the technical problems had to be worked out, and all of that is going on, right? All right. We can now envision, and I'm going to repeat myself from last time, I do this process for two different purposes. One is what's called human gene editing. I can also edit genes in all kinds of other organisms. CRISPR-edited tomatoes, you probably eat it. CRISPR-edited tomatoes already, unless you routinely buy very soggy organic tomatoes. Okay? They're being used to generate tomatoes that remain fresher all the time. Probably quite a few of you, if you eat meat, will probably have eaten CRISPR-edited pork by now. It's being used routinely. It's being used in chickens. It's being used all over the place. And the first legal somatic gene editing for human using CRISPR is being tried out right now, and so far has proved to be somewhat successful. We think for gene editing purposes, it will. There really do not appear to be that many technical hurdles that have to be crossed. And both the rest of today, okay. So I am somewhere here now in my wonderful. I'm actually trying to be methodical for once and have a list of topics I want to cover. I'm over here. The rest of today will be spent about genetic diseases and where we may or may not go with there and what the ethical problems are. And the next class, we're going to take into the worry more systematically about gene enhancement and why everybody worries about it so much. Everybody with me? The second use of CRISPR, which is the one that personally I work on and I find fascinating, is its use to try to spread genes that will destroy species. So what's an example of that? I talked about this example in class sometime. I take this this mosquito called Aedes. I did talk about this last time, right? It wasn't my notes. Of course, since I didn't bring my notes to class, there might be no correspondence between what was in my notes and what I say in class. Aedes aegypti is the mosquito that spreads viruses such as dengue, chikungunya, and Zika, right? You are quite likely to have seen it, maybe not because it's being replaced in Central Texas by Aedes albopictus. These are the mosquitoes that have black and white legs, striped legs. Often they're called tiger mosquitoes and things like that. So in that, we can insert such a gene in the X chromosome in such a way that a female mosquito begins to develop male characteristics and eventually becomes male, right? And then when the reproduction takes on, as every generation goes on, the females, more and more of the females, get what is called satirized, okay? They have more and more male characteristics, and ultimately the males completely take over the population, and the population dies out because the males can't reproduce by themselves. Now, you don't really have to kill the population, get the population entirely to die out. If you get the population to be about 95% male, that's almost enough to control the disease. Because remember, male mosquitoes do not bite people and don't spread disease. And they don't consume blood at all. Male mosquitoes live entirely on nectar. Everybody with me? It's only the females that have blood meals, and they do so exactly before laying eggs. And those blood meals is what spread diseases. So if you systematically convert the females into males, you have more or less controlled the disease. Everybody with me so far? And that kind of use is called gene drive. Okay. And next Tuesday, Zach Adelman, who's the person who has shown that you can have a CRISPR system for this particular species, he's a faculty member at Texas A&M. He has to confirm, but he's supposed to be the speaker next Tuesday in class. He'll talk about that, and he'll point out what the ethical problems of using gene drives are, and I'll take up the theme on the class right after that, Zach is a lot more worried about using gene drives, as I told you in class, than I am. I would happily like to drive some of these mosquito species extinct. I don't think there is a serious ethical worry there about what we're doing, though I would not want to carry out gene drives for anything much bigger than a mosquito because of unintended consequences of what it could do to the ecology of a region. Everybody with me? Okay. And we can also worry if somebody's interested about arguments about the intrinsic value of species and stuff like that, the sort of stuff I normally do in my environmental ethics class. But I'm willing to discuss this if this comes up next week. I want to get back to gene editing for the rest of this week. Everybody with me? All right. So gene editing, okay, itself can be of two types, all right? I could edit the somatic cell genes in you, right? And in that case, of course, the edited genes continue in your body but do not go on to the next generation. And as far as I'm concerned, the ethical status of something like that is no different than my putting up any other thing inside you, whether it be an artificial organ, or I decide to correct your circulatory system by inserting a bit of tube, or I insert a valve to replace a bad valve in your heart. Everybody with me? They don't really raise any ethical concern. It's intrusive as hell, yes it is. But sometimes with some diseases, other than being intrusive, we know no other way of controlling it. Everybody with me? Just as we, for example, have no clue on what to do with appendicitis except surgery. We have to accept that intrusive medicine is necessary in this particular situation, and gene drive is just a very chemically intrusive way. You should think of it the analogy of doing surgery by laser. Some people were horrified by using laser for surgery inside your eyes or wherever it is. Nowadays, you can carry out to remove gallbladder stones and stuff like that because you are sending very, very high-powered radiation inside your body. Well, in gene drives, you're sending a particular kind of chemical that will change the gene. And that's what the idea of editing genes in this way has been around since the 1980s. In the early 2000s, there were many, many attempts right after the Human Genome Project, and they were all uniformly failures. Something always seemed to go wrong. But with CRISPR, we finally appear to have a gene editing technology that actually is precise and works. People, of course, worry about safety, and they have to be, and that's partly what is being tested right now. It looks like it'll work. The reason it's not controversial, right, is that everybody recognizes the safety problems, but it's not going to change the future. Your children would still inherit the bad gene that you had in the next generation, and we would have to go. If something else doesn't turn up in the meantime, use gene editing again to try to correct those. Everybody with me? Everybody has a complete different attitude towards all this when we go and say we will intervene in the embryo and change the germline itself, because you are affecting the future genetic composition of the human population. Everybody with me? And this horrifies people, and why? Okay. Anything like this, where you target a trait, right? You decide to intervene at the genetic level. Okay. And you control reproduction to do so. And here the reproduction control is being, you interfere in the embryo and change a gene in it. Anything like this, by my and modern definitions, will be called eugenic. And this, of course, goes back to the idea of eugenics that was prominent in the early part of the 20th century. All right? Okay. Now, eugenics as a term is, I am going to put up a chapter on the complexity of that, as a term has never easily been properly defined. It's sort of this idea that you somehow, the basic idea is that you go and you intervene in a population at the genetic level however you want to. Okay. One way of doing so is taking people who you think have undesirable characteristics that would be inherited, and you forcibly sterilize them. A slightly more extreme way of doing it, and as I told you in class last time, involuntary sterilization has been a very, very major part of U.S. social policy in almost all states for a long, long time, starting in the 1910s and ending in some states only in the 1980s. Everybody with me? Though it's no longer luckily carried out, obviously violates all kinds of things and all of that. And a slightly more extreme one is you take things that you take to be unfit, like people who are mentally ill, and you just kill them. Okay? If you kill them, then they're not able to reproduce. Genes don't go on to the next generation. This technique was perfected by the Nazis, right? When they targeted mentally ill people and homosexuals for elimination in their death camps, and simultaneously they decided that the gypsies and Jews were also genetically inferior and they should all belong there. Everybody with me? Given that history, you probably should not be surprised that eugenics has a very negative connotation for most of us in almost all social circumstances, right? And sometimes I even worry that people who want to advocate, okay, genetic intervention at the population level, whether they should ever have decided to use or rehabilitate the word eugenics, or they should have just avoided it altogether in order to avoid the negative connotation. Now, if it had been up to me, I would never have used the word eugenic. I would have argued for all of this in terms of why it is desirable and when it is not desirable, social policy. The upshot of all of this should be, by the way, is that most of us think, but I'll also explain people on the other side, right, that and you're going to see in Stuart Newman, my close friend who completely disagrees with me, most of us think that in some circumstances, okay, intervening to get rid of some horrible disease genes in the human population is permitted. Most of us also think we are not willing to touch the issue of genetic enhancement of future generations, of trying to make future generations, you know, faster runners or better jumpers or more better at silly puzzle solving. That's called IQ. and things of that sort. Most of us don't believe we want to touch that, but we are willing to do this. Everybody with me? But it's all controversial, and I'm certainly not pushing you to take any particular policy stand. What I want you to get used to is the idea of thinking hard about it, because I spent all of last class reminding you over and over again, these are choices in social policy your generation will have to face. Everybody with me? Okay? All right. Now notice that this very, very minimal direct definition, right, of eugenics, and sometimes you'll add to this a fourth criteria, a no coercion rule. All of this will have to be through informed individual choice, right? No coercion. If you add all of that, then what results is called liberal eugenics. And that is a technical term right now. And mainly the people who really push for it are people who come from libertarian backgrounds and things like that. And then, of course, once you get to that no coercion rule and you're serious about it, you automatically rule out Nazi death camps and American sterilization. Everybody with me? They seem to have gotten rid of the most offensive aspect of what has been called eugenics in the past. Okay. All right. And then usually the next distinction people make after this is between positive versus negative eugenics. Positive eugenics is encourage spread of something. And negative eugenics is discourage spread. And roughly, this is going to correspond now in our modern situation. That distinction was made in the early 20th century. In our modern thing, this will correspond to genetic enhancement. And this will correspond to gene elimination. Okay. Now, as far as negative eugenics went, also until CRISPR, right? And CRISPR-like technology, one of the other objections that people always had to this whole process is their standard objection to the morality of abortion. Okay? One standard technique in carrying out negative eugenics was to look at fetuses that, say, were homozygous for some disease allele and abort them. And anybody who thinks abortion is morally unacceptable would have objections to that. Everybody with me? And this is the other thing I like about CRISPR, is it solves that problem for us. We don't have to have abortions. We intervene and change the genes in the embryo. We do not kill the embryo. Everybody with me? So one more way in which, so to say, we have an acceptable, tame genetic technology that might do wonders for us in the future. And we'll shortly be dealing with problems over and over again. Okay? What's an example of negative eugenics? So look, so what does not count as eugenics? So when eugenics became popular in the US, people kept on saying that people who think that who have tendencies which are not desirable, they should voluntarily use birth control or refrain from reproducing. Well, that's included even now, but by itself, birth control, which does influence the future genetic composition of a population, is not eugenics. Okay, because you're not consciously trying to influence the future genetic composition of a population. Every aspect of a policy that is eugenic, these clauses have to be consciously applied. And that rules out lots of things. Marriage rules. Take the most restrictive marriage rules the world has seen, the Hindu caste system, right? Where you can only marry within the caste, but then you have to marry not within subcastes. It's complicated as hell. Somebody wrote a book called Homo Hierarchicus trying to explain the caste system, the Hindu caste system. And it's also, as almost everybody in the modern era will come out and say, it's also one of the most oppressive social systems human beings have ever designed. But it does not qualify as eugenics. You're not getting all these conscious different things over here. Okay? A more funny case, which you'll get in your reading, is something that happened in Singapore in the 1980s. The rulers of the city-state decided that their birth rate was falling, and in particular, the birth rate was falling among the more educated people, and they assumed, they were happy to use the term eugenic for what they wanted to do, and they assumed that the ability to graduate from college was controlled by heredity and could be inherited, and they began this wonderful program where they were trying to encourage people with college degrees to reproduce. So they often took couples or singles, single men and single women on fancy boat trips that they paid for. They encouraged they gave all kinds of monetary benefits and all of that, trying to get these people to reproduce. They gave sex advice, all kinds of stuff to get these people to actually have sex and have babies. And a lot of money was devoted to it. Clearly there was some eugenic intent in all of this, and they used the term, but it doesn't really qualify as eugenics, because it started out with a very silly idea that there's a genetic basis to college graduation. Everybody with me? Okay. I mean, not a genetic basis, some genes are involved somewhere, a genetic basis in the sense of controllable heredity in college graduation. Everybody with me? Okay. So this is a very circumscribed, okay, definition of it. And now the debate becomes, when is it applicable? Yeah. To say that something is actually genetic, we have to have empirical data that show that controlling at that locus, right, will result in the trait being changed. Almost all the claims about stupidity and of those different kinds of stupidity, right? You had morons at the bottom, imbeciles at the bottom, then morons. There were seven categories there. All those claims
were based on false claims about experimental results. The experimental results have to be right to show that something is genetic. So you could do it by pedigree analysis. So if you'd look at Huntington's disease, you can trace it down a pedigree, and every time an individual inherits a single one of those alleles, the individual will have the disease. So you have to play the game that you could also play in Drosophila or something else to strongly establish that genes control the disease through linkage studies, pedigree studies, a lot of things like that. The problem with almost everything that was done in the 1920s in the name of eugenics is that the data were largely invented or hoped for but did not actually exist. They just took it to be obvious that intelligence was inherited. Just they took it to be obvious that North Europeans were brighter than South Europeans or East Europeans. That's what the Immigration Control Act of 1924 established, the superiority of the Nordic races over everybody else. All of this was just entirely the fake data that they were using and all of that. But that's how you need to establish it. And that's exactly what you can't do about college graduation rates in Singapore. Okay. What will qualify as genetic? Well, take the following situation. There's a disease called Tay-Sachs disease. How many of you have heard of it? Most of you have, and you probably know it's pretty horrible. Children with it rarely survive over the age 5. They seem to be normal for about 6 months, begin to lose all kinds of motor abilities after that, including suddenly losing the ability to sit up, crawl, and things of that sort, and they eventually degenerate and die. There is an enhanced percentage of the Tay-Sachs alleles in Ashkenazi Jewish communities in North America. And that has been known since the 1950s or so, just as, say, South Asian or African origin or Middle East, Mediterranean origin people have enhanced frequencies of the sickle cell allele. Ashkenazi Jewish populations in North America have an enhanced frequency of the Tay-Sachs allele. Massive attempt at genetic counseling all through the 1980s, early 1990s, right? In which individuals who are heterozygotes, it's a recessive allele, individuals who are heterozygotes for the Tay-Sachs allele were discouraged from marrying. Or if they married and they had they were about to have babies, very early in pregnancy, amniocentesis was used to find out whether the fetus was carrying 2 copies of the allele, and if it was, selective abortion was carried out. Remember, this is a community that did not have religious objections or very deep personal objections to abortion by and large. And so they did not eliminate the disease, but they decreased its occurrence by a factor of 9. This clearly does constitute eugenics under this definition. Everybody with me? You track something, okay, a disease, a trait, the Tay-Sachs trait. You assume and decide that it was genetic, and you're right. Right? And you decide you're going to intervene at the genetic level rather than getting rid of the disease by designing medicine around it, right? Treatments or anything like that. And then you made reproductive choices. Okay? Don't marry your first cousin. That's sort of the choice I like to talk about when you talk about recessives, right? Avoid inbreeding to the extent you can, even in a small community. And more than that, use selective abortion. That's about as big a reproductive choice as you can make, and see what happens, right? And it satisfies liberal eugenics, because at the end of the day, counseling is counseling, right? You're not being required to do so. And some couples decided that they would go and have babies with the Tay-Sachs allele and did, right? Of course, here we have a serious issue of causes. How do we understand coercion, right? And I am going to leave that to say by saying it's very complicated. It's one thing to say coercion is occurring because the state intervenes and, you know, snips your fallopian tubes, right? An involuntary sterilization, that's clearly coercive. If somebody comes and gasses you, right, like the Nazis did, that clearly is coercive. But when there's a lot of societal pressure, look, you're carrying the Tay-Sachs allele, right? Therefore, you should not reproduce with somebody else who carries the Tay-Sachs allele. Aren't there plenty of other partners you could choose? And this is just driven to you on and on and on and on, day in and day out. When does that end up being coercive? I'm not going to be able to solve that problem for you. Clearly, there's an entire spectrum here
but we don't just face it in the case of eugenics. We face this issue of coercion over and over again in capital and economic coercion in particular in capitalist society, right? When are you going to be forced to make a particular choice because you're worried about the financial situation in your family? When are you making a particular choice for things like prostitution, pornography, and all of that, where you're doing things with your body you would not otherwise do, but you feel compelled by economic circumstance to do it? Everybody with me? All the stuff, the horrible stuff we are hearing about out of Venezuela now and how it's affected women. Coercion comes in a variety of levels and for a variety of purposes. The idea is to be sensitive to the issue while acknowledging that certainly not in a philosophy and medicine course, it's not going to be solved to anyone's satisfaction. Okay? All right. Now, what are the two things that we have to do now? What are the arguments for carrying out this kind of courses, and what are they? Okay. The first one is that you are trying to prevent a particular trait from spreading, right? Who and how is the trait selected? So I decide that you have a facial tic, and I don't like it. And quite likely, for some types of facial tics, there is a genetic basis, right? Should that be eliminated? And who judges? In the case of liberal eugenics, let's say you and some others in your community decide, they find out that this particular trait is recessive, has a recessive allele associated with you, and you sort of establish a code of behavior that voluntarily follow, saying two people with tics never marry, or whatever, never have a child together. Okay, everybody, that's what I mean when I'm saying never marry in this context, never have a child together. Did somebody do anything wrong? Clearly not. That's a reproductive choice you can make and all of it. So in some sense, it has to be left open-ended as to what trait you desire or you not desire. After all, our idea of reproductive freedom is it even lets you make a choice that I won't have a child with this person because I don't want the offspring to have blue eyes, or I do want the offspring to have blue eyes. Nothing can prevent you from doing that. Everybody with me? And it's not clear that society should intervene to prevent you from doing that. There can be arguments on the other side. As all of you know, I have a bias towards libertarian attitudes towards all of this, and so I always present those first, but somebody can say otherwise. Yeah. Myopia, yeah, that's the other one. Somebody can say, well, you know, I don't want my child to grow up with wearing glasses and all of that, and I could voluntarily choose not to reproduce because of that, and nobody can actually prevent me. But that's a classic example of something that clearly has some heritable basis, right, myopia, but which we can control so easily by eyeglasses that in this day and age, nobody worries about it. It's a perfect example of a genetic condition that in some obvious sense is undesirable because it presents some problems for you, but technological advancement has been such that it doesn't matter. Everybody with me? Okay, a genetic solution. So there's a serious issue of where we draw the line, right? Okay, then there are, and this is a community that has to be taken very seriously because social policy rarely does. The community of people with disabilities, okay? And it was driven home to me a couple of times way back when I was a graduate student in the 1980s of listening to people give evidence when the Human Genome Project was being thought of, is that people should not make judgments about the quality of life of others. Okay. Lots of people with disabilities say that when people like you go and say eliminate this and eliminate that, are we suggesting that we eliminate these people? And we are in very murky territory here, and we have to be extremely careful, right? Okay. All right. And the way I want to be careful about this one is by using my favorite example, whom I've mentioned in class before, but he's a wonderful example of somebody carrying a debilitating genetic disease, and look at the effect he has. How many of you have heard of a musician, a singer, songwriter called Woody Guthrie? only one or two people raise your hands. Country changes a lot, right? How many of you had this song called This Land Is Your Land? This land is, okay, now everybody's hand goes up. Woody Guthrie wrote that song, right, and all of it. And do you know what that song was in response to? Anybody know that? It was in response to God Bless America. He was sick and tired of listening to God Bless America when it first came out, and the song was originally written as a communist response to God Bless America, and eventually it got tamed and it's sung in churches and stuff like that, just as Dylan's, you know, what's a Dylan song that's sung always in church? I'm forgetting it now. I'll come back in a second. Anyway, look, Woody Guthrie is somebody who eventually died of Huntington's disease, which he inherited from his mother, and luckily his son, there's one allele for it, his son Arlo Guthrie has not inherited it. And he's very much part and parcel of American culture. This Land Is My Land was performed during Obama's inauguration, for example, in the White House. So this is a very, very, very important case. And are we saying, when we want to say that we want to get rid of the disease the gene for Huntington's disease, are we trying to say that somebody like Woody Guthrie was not worthwhile? Everybody with me? And if you even think it that way, you've said something pretty stupid. Okay? Now, the point over here is that the question comes up. What if you had Woody Guthrie and you're in a situation that the person's the same, right? Otherwise the same, brought up in the same way, growing up during the Dust Bowl, you know, moving from Oklahoma to California, walking most of the way, walking and singing and all of that, the complicated history, except the person just does not have the Huntington's disease allele. And Woody Guthrie, that Huntington's disease is a wonderful example to use there, because there's no sign of the disease typically until you're in the 40s. You're completely normal and all of that, and which is why until people began to understand the disease, people in general passed on the gene to future generations without thinking, because at the time they were reproducing, right, they had seen no sign that they had any serious illness, any kind. So almost all families in which the disease runs have some sort of family tradition of knowing that something peculiar goes on in the family in terms of insanity and all of that late in life, and you wonder whether or not you inherited your father's condition or your mother's condition. There have been lots and lots of interviews done of these people, which is what I'm quoting when I'm using that example. Now you come back and tell me that Woody Guthrie would not have been Woody Guthrie had he not had this ailment. Okay, it's part of his identity. Now, I intentionally loaded this case in my favor because with Huntington's disease, having that ailment was not something that at all enters into the personality that Woody Guthrie was. But even if it did, what are we to make of it? Right? And the usual answer is, how often do you see these people getting to the stage of being a functional, responsible adult, right? And then being willing to make the decision. So take your myopia example. You have tons of people who have myopia, who are functional adults that can make informed decisions about themselves, and they'll tell you they're fine. In fact, whatever it is, they're wearing glasses. I am one of them. My wearing glasses is part and parcel of who I take my appearance, who I take myself to be. Everybody with me? Okay, it's part of my dress code for most purposes. Others might say, no, I would have liked not to have the gene for this. Whatever it is, you have to listen to them. But when you're talking about a disease like Tay-Sachs that's going to kill you off by age 5, right, or muscular dystrophy and all of that, I don't think this kind of disability or advocacy rules out the possibility of trying to eliminate the gene. Everybody with me? Look, this issue is a little complicated. I was hoping the time's up, so let me come back to it because I need another 10 minutes on the elimination of disease before I go to enhancement. All right, we covered a fair amount today, right?